Now, as some of you know, I'm a big fan of a short novel by Dutch writer Sees Notenboom, namely this one, The Following Story, whose protagonist and narrator falls asleep at home in Amsterdam, but inexplicably wakes up the next morning in Lisbon. I can't tell you very much more about the plot without spoiling it for you. But at last check, copies were available at Blackwell's on Park Street, so I encourage you to go read it. What I can tell you is that the story is rich in references to Ovid's Metamorphoses. Indeed, when I teach The Following Story, and I've had not one but two occasions to do so this year in two different classes on Ovid's epic, I present the novel to my students as a witty elaboration of the poem's final word, "Wiwam," I shall live. In other words, Ovid has told us in the preceding lines, he shall live on the lips of readers who will make his name indelibile, unerasable, at least as long as Rome and its language will themselves last, one of several notes of ambiguity in what you might at first mistake for authorial vanity triumphant. It's one of classical literature's most famous endings, and it has become emblematic of the view that the true life of a text begins only once it is handed off to readers, a notion that can be said to lie at the true heart of the classical tradition that is the final part of the name of the institute that has brought us all here this evening. What, you may well be wondering, does a Dutch novelist reading Ovid have to do with tonight's speaker reading Sallust? I don't mean merely to conjure the similar magic by which our speaker went to bed a few days ago in America and woke up this morning in Bristol. Nor is my point a key resemblance between our speaker and Notenboom's narrator, namely that both are teachers of classics with a wide range of interests, but a strong penchant for Ovid. And as you've already heard, Professor Feldherr's most recent book is his Plain Gods, Ovid's Metamorphoses and the Politics of Fiction, which I have here suitably bookmarked from my own.
Is that available for sale?
I don't actually know that.
Yeah, good luck with that.
And only a small part of my motivation in making a connection between Notenboom and Feldherr lies in the opportunity it affords to compare the odd temporalities embodied both by Notenboom's title and by the title of the series of lectures that Andrew has launched tonight. Notenboom's Following Story is simultaneously the story that comes next and the story that follows along behind the writer as he writes. Like Ovid, he can say, "I shall live in the future," because he has written in the past. So too, to borrow Andrew's own words, does Sallust, quote, make the last event in his narrative, the victor's tour of bodies on the battlefield, also the first event in its reception, unquote. Reception here technically refers to the events rather than their retelling, but of course we've just heard Andrew describe Sallust's deliberate efforts to confuse these two categories, mixing historical time with the present tense of reading. Quote, Sallust gains his wisdom by positioning himself not only after events, but after the representation of events, unquote. And so on, and in other ways, playing with a reader's sense of distance and or contiguity with the past. From the tension between these two quantities, Andrew has told us, has come his own punning title, After the Past. Ovid looks forward to poetic immortality, Sallust looks back at the deadly work of history, but both inevitably raise the question of perspective, to borrow a word from today's title, i.e. the question of where we are right now in relation to what we are reading. But no, my real reason for comparing Feldherr and Notenboom is another one entirely. Events prevent the latter's protagonist from delivering the final lecture of his teaching career, which, he tells us, was to be on the closing section of Cicero's De Amicitia, though he tells us no more than that. I could not help noticing that Andrew makes an almost equally fleeting reference to the very same passage. As you've probably already worked out, I had an advanced copy of his lecture. I haven't done this all from memory. And I'll quote Andrew, "Virtus becomes what transcends temporal boundaries. Thus, after the death of his friend Scipio, Cicero's Laelius will say, quote, he lives for me because I love the virtus of the man which has not been snuffed out, unquote. Here's the fuller quote. It's on your handout, I believe. Quote, although he has been taken from me suddenly, vivit tamen semperque vivit. He lives all the same and will always live. Cicero's narrator writes of his friend in the sentence Andrew excerpts, blending past, present, and future in a single closing gesture of true friendship. And the word that enables this temporal blending is clear from the wider context. Memoria, the memory in which Scipio now will live. Indeed, memory is such a key concept in the De Amicitia, the word itself appears over and over in the dialogue's preface, that the work could almost as aptly have been titled De Memoria. And part of the reason, surely, is that Cicero, writing in the fall of 44 BC, months after the assassination of Julius Caesar, is not merely memorializing the distant past, but wondering what will be remembered of himself and of Rome's fragile present. Verba volant scripta manet, spoken words fly away, but written ones remain. For this so-called dialogue, as had been the case throughout Cicero's long career as an author, writing is the only reliable guarantor of memory. But in that final passage, he borrows the title term of Brutus's De Virtute, which Brutus had dedicated to Cicero himself, as Andrew has reminded us. Theirs was a complicated friendship, to be sure. Cicero was excluded from the conspiracy to kill Caesar. But after the deed, Brutus shouted to the crowd a single name, whether in explanation or dedication we are never told, namely Cicero. In any case, it is Scipio's virtus that Laelius says has been imprinted indelibly into his own memory. And sweet as this sentiment may seem, it represents, for reasons that Andrew has helped us to understand this evening, an oxymoron. Can one really remember virtue? Doesn't one instead remember signs of virtue, i.e. virtuous words and deeds? Hidden music gets you nowhere, went an ancient proverb. And the same would seem to be true of hidden virtus, useless to one's contemporaries and invisible to history. Scipio himself hardly kept his virtus hidden. But if he had done, could Laelius have loved him all the same? Probably not. Indeed, the question would have made little sense to him. But the fact that he is being ventriloquized by Cicero the writer raises the stakes here. Can virtue or other moral qualities, including virtue's opposites, be remembered in the sense of being written about if they do not externalize themselves? Or to turn this around, can any Roman who aims to write about virtus, including not just philosophizing orators like Cicero, but also philosophizing historians like Sallust, avoid transforming virtus into fama, glory or fame, won through deeds and words? The question echoes a proposition Andrew has just interrogated, namely, quote, if Sallust readers could simply recognize true virtus, and if they could actualize their own virtue in a way that made it independent of fama, then, one might suppose, ambition and avarice would fall away, unquote. Andrew goes on to say, quote, I would like to believe that such a possibility exists, not just for the Roman's sake, but for my own, unquote. But as you've heard, he ultimately finds in his material something rather more complicated. Indeed, nothing less than historiography as, quote, quite literally the field of combat for the struggle between the revelation of timeless truths and their contestation, unquote. And while Andrew thus winds up with some penetrating insights into the ends of history for someone like Sallust, i.e. history's moral purpose, I don't think we should lose sight of what he also has illuminated for us tonight. Namely, Sallust's eloquent yet meditation on the means and limits of history. And as is suggested by Andrew's opening image of his own encounter with photographs of plaster casts of spaces left by bodies buried under Vesuvian ash, or so we're told, those means and limits are best understood in mediatic terms. Let me explain. In a throwaway comment on his first book, Greg Nagy calls kleos, the Greek word that corresponds to Latin fama, the ancient world's first medium. What he means by this is clear from context, devoted to the formulas and metrical patterns of prehistoric oral poetry. which enabled the stories told by that poetry to be remembered, repeated, and even to acquire a reasonably fixed form that persisted over time. In other words, klaus is not merely the consequence of virtue, arete in Greek. Rather, it is part and parcel of the mechanisms that enable that virtue to be recorded, even before the adoption of writing. And so it may well be possible to say that, throughout antiquity, both for the person who wants to remember, for example, writers like Cicero and Sallust, and for the person who wants to be remembered, for example, doers like Cicero and Catiline, the logic of klaus and fama remained difficult to escape. And more often than not, that logic was a brutal, violent one. Thus, to give just one example, after Cato argues for the execution of the conspirators in custody, Sallust tells us that the consulars and senators praised him for having just demonstrated his own virtus. Just as those photographed plaster casts make a claim, quote, to capture the past as it really was, unquote, so too Andrew sets out to show us, does Sallust seek to create, quote, an impression that the narrative itself is produced by the events it describes, unquote. And at the end of his paper, he contemplates the ending of a text that seeks not just to represent the past, but to function as a kind of grim souvenir of it. Quote, in the real world, Andrew observes, which is the world Sallust's conclusion seeks to absorb, the bodies are what we see and the souls we can only conjecture, unquote. But the same hermeneutic problem confronts us off the battlefield, too, in ordinary life, in all of its three tenses. It was perhaps inevitable, I would suggest, that this problem would take center stage in a text that mixes history not just with philosophy, but with biography, that is to say, with the writing down of life, bios itself. The reader, Andrew tells us, must finally ask Sallust, quote, whether his text can represent anything at all, unquote, just as Sallust himself asks in the end whether a body can tell us about anything other than ourselves. But the question is not terribly different when we are instead reading Ovid's poem of forms changed into new bodies. Ovid, of course, can hardly be said to be interested in virtus. But what he maybe shares with the Sallust Andrew has brought to life for us tonight is an attempt to convince us that the people around us, no matter what form they take, even when this form reduces them to silence, have inner lives as real as our own. And I'm thinking here as much of Sallust's failed political career as I am of Ovidian characters transformed into trees and cows. But wait, isn't this the same Sallust who opens his treatise by declaring that what distinguishes humans from other animals is their determination, quote, not to pass their lives in silence, like livestock, unquote? Yes. But that's not the same as supposing that one could read a Roman's mind by reading his CV or his epitaph. Between silence and the tyranny of the cursus honorum, Sallust sought a tertium quid. So, too, arguably, had Catiline, for whom Sallust shows a quiet but unmistakable sympathy, even though he finally condemns him as a criminal who offers nothing more than a grotesque parody of the Roman quest for glory. Sallust found a better way as a writer, one whose virtue as a writer Andrew has shown us today and doubtless will continue to show us in the days to come, may yet to have received a full accounting. Thank you.